Liveline on RTE Radio 1 with Kia. Going electric? Go really electric with an EV or plug-in hybrid from the Kia e-range.
Kia. Movement that inspires.
Say, by a horde of screeching bagpipers, a jiggery of Irish dancers, a battalion of cold majorettes, and a fleet of flatbed trucks in second gear. And so, the St. Patrick's Day parade, 'twas born. And then the world stopped. But the people of Ireland, undaunted, took to their gardens, their back kitchens and good sitting rooms, and lined out on their bit of road frontage, and the RTE virtual parade was born.
Yes, the RTE virtual parade is back. Get yourself online this St. Patrick's Day and share your home parade with the world. Just keep it local, keep it distant, and use the hashtag RTE Virtual Parade. The RTE Virtual Parade.
In partnership with St. Patrick's Festival.
RTE Radio 1. Liveline on RTE Radio 1 with Kia. Going electric? Plug into the Kia Niro plug-in hybrid.
Kia. Movement that inspires.
1850 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon, and you're very welcome to Liveline. And Joe at RT.ie. Remember yesterday's programme and the day before, dominated by calls about this priest, Jesuit priest, Father Joseph Marmion. He was revealed in a statement by the Jesuits this week. They say that he was an abuser and a paedophile, and they say they received information about him first in 1977. They received information from concerned parents. Disclosures of sexual abuse were received by the school. In consequence, a decision was taken that Joseph Marmion be removed from the staff in Belvedere with effect from the end of the academic year 1977-78, which was 9 months later. He then was moved to Paris. Then he was moved to Gardiner Street, Jesuit community around the corner from Belvedere. Then he was appointed in 1990 chaplain, Jesuit chaplain to St. Vincent's private hospital. And the Jesuits say at the end of their statement, they say that we... it is our policy. It is our policy to inform the Gardaí and to Tusla of any disclosures. Well, it wasn't their policy, obviously, in 1977, if not before, because a number of other former students have contacted us, including Ruchard O'Tierney, who's on WhatsApp. Ruchard, good afternoon.
How are you, Joe?
How are you doing? Can you bring us back, Ruchard, to 1977? This is when the Jesuit order said they first heard these allegations about Marmion.
Yeah, I was in a double class from 1976 to 1977 on with Joseph Marmion. Mm-hmm. So there was about 2 times 25, so there was about 50 guys, and we had him for German. Yeah. And at the in the summer of 1977, he took a group of them to on tour to Vienna. Okay. And in September of 1977, I arrived back into school. And most years, you know, you'd be comparing music. What mm-hmm. records were you listening to recently? What did you get up to? This, that, and the other. But in those two classes, and certainly probably in the rest of that particular year of boys, the number one subject was what had happened in Vienna.
Okay.
And it was absolutely frightening. I had never heard anything like this in my life. I knew Marmion was a bully, but this was like totally beyond the beyonds. So according to what I heard in those first days in September in 1977, now I'm going to say that I never spoke to any victim who had anything done to them by Marmion in Vienna.
Okay.
I spoke to people some of the boys who were on the tour.
Right.
And it seemed to be the case, from my understanding and from all the talk, from talking to different people and us all trying to make sense of it, right? Mm-hmm. That one or other of the boys had been diagnosed or something by Marmion as having a cold, something like that. And like, you know, maybe he should stay the night in Marmion's room and he would look after him and this, that, and the other. Mm-hmm. And there was mention of a rectal examination with the thermometer, mm-hmm. which kind of we didn't know. Like, that is a standard practice in, let's say, the continent, but we wouldn't have known that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, so we didn't know the context for that either. And so, like, and there was the suggestion that, I don't know, that some of the lads had to get him out of there or something. You know, I wasn't really sure. And I think that is the case now, that they actually did do that, two fellas. And the guy had been doped and all of that. And I take my hat off to those two fellow pupils of mine. Classmates of mine.
So they were alleging. Now, remember, you're backed up in the sense that the Jesuit order say, following receipt of information from concerned parents in 1977, disclosures of sexual abuse were received by the school. In consequence, a decision was taken that Joseph Marmion be removed from the staff in Belvedere with effect from the end of the academic year. That was 9 months later, by the way. So it does fit.
Yes.
What you're saying does fit. And the Jesuit order are now saying that they were disclosures, not allegations. They're accepting them. Obviously, they've called them, they've publicly named them as a paedophile. They believe them now, these allegations. So what happened with these allegations, Rookard? Did they go beyond the conversation of the pupils or the students in the school?
Well, I hated Marmion. I knew he was a bully. Mm. My dad and my mom always taught me to not take any crap from bullies. And I never had, you know. So, like, I'm listening to this. I'm 15 years of age. And what do you do? So, anyway, my dad was teaching in the school.
Okay.
He's a member, a lay member of the staff. Fairly well liked, I think. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Popular, et cetera, et cetera. And I was the apple of his eye. And I looked up to him, like, massively, whatever. So, I said, geez, I better tell me dad. So, we're driving home out to Sutton then. I would say, in that still first week after we get back. Okay. From summer holidays. And I said, Dad, listen to me. Something awful happened in Vienna. Hmm. I don't know what the hell. I can't make head or tail of it. It's all kind of hush hush. Hmm. But it seems like, and I think I knew the boy's name at the time. And I think I mentioned his, I don't know, did I say his name directly to my dad? I don't know. I said, such and such was landed into his room and some of the lads had to get him out or something. And I think I maybe mentioned the thing about the thermometer. I don't know. And my dad was shocked. Like, there was a big discussion about Marmion yesterday. I'm sure Dad knew that Marmion was kind of a bully, but I'm sure he wouldn't. Marmion would have avoided because my dad wouldn't have, you know. If I just like to say, Joe, okay, we can do with that for the minute. Okay, so my dad is there and so I've put him in a position, you know. And he says, look, leave it with me, right? Okay. So the next day we went into school, and then we're coming home in the evening. And he says, I spoke to the principal, to Noel Barber, about that there today. I said, where did you meet him? In his office, I think, you know, confidential. Mm-hmm. And I said, what did you tell him? Well, he said, there seems to, Father Barber, there seems to have something have happened in Vienna, something drastic, something seriously untoward involving Father Marmion and the boys in, we just started fourth year. He said, it's all the talk.
Right.
Barber, apparently, now I'm not party to the conversation. I can only recall what my dad told me of it. So he said,
we won't, given that you don't know
I know that. But what he says was, he says, well, what do you think, Rookert? He said, what do you think? And my dad said to him, he said, if Rookert came to me and said it to me, I think there must be something to it.
Okay.
And he left it then with Noel Barber. And I would say on Noel Barber's behalf, I had more than one run-in getting into scrapes in Belvedere College, because I was a kind of a messer, you know. And any time I landed up in front of him, he always treated me extremely fairly.
He was a
good principal, and I would assume that he made his own investigations and tried to find out what the hell.
77 was the date when things started moving. But stay with us, Rookard, because I want to bring in Gerald Fitzgerald. Gerald, good afternoon. Hello, Gerald.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Loud and clear, Gerald. Your history and stories about Marmion go back way before 77.
Yeah, that's why I contacted your program yesterday, because I heard part of the program and the focus seemed to be on the 1970s, and indeed the statement by the Jesuits referred to the 1970s and 1977 when they received, I think, it seems, the first complaint. But I was in Plongos from 1958 to 63, and Marmion was appointed headmaster, prefect of studies with the title, in 1963.
Okay.
No, 1962.
Okay.
It would have been, 62, 63. And he hadn't been in the school before, so he was appointed from outside.
Right.
Sorry, that's my
no worries.
I need to get rid of that.
Okay, take your time.
Sorry, Joe.
Grand, no word.
Just turn that off.
So he's in the school in Clongowes in 1962.
That's
beginning.
Right. Now I'm off that mobile. Sorry.
Okay. What do you remember of his behaviour then?
Well, he was a very clever, sophisticated man. He loved classical music and all that kind of thing. He was an expert in sarcasm and cutting remarks, and he had a kind of menacing presence, really. Mm-hmm. He was very different to the other Jesuits in the place who were, generally perfectly normal people.
Yeah.
But he seemed to be kind of on the prowl looking for victims, I suppose, for trouble anyway. And I contacted the program really just to say that it didn't just start in the 1970s, while I was not aware of any sexual abuse and was shocked by that revelation, I have to say, I had direct experience of emotional abuse by Joe Marmion in my final year, just to give you two examples of that. I had to go to the dentist in Dublin on one occasion, had permission from the infirmary to go, and when he found I had left the school without his permission, he called me to his office and gave me six of the best, as we called it.
Right.
In other words, six slaps with the leather on each hand. I said to him, I didn't realize I needed your consent to go to Dublin. I don't know whether I did, in fact, or not, but whether I did or not, the punishment, was completely disproportionate. He did some other things, too, which were targeted at me to punish me for minor infringements in a completely disproportionate way. And he called me to his office quite late in my time there, probably shortly before I left, and he told me that in his opinion I was a failure, and I couldn't understand it really, because I was auditor of the debating society.
Okay.
I had been in the school play, I was editor of the school magazine, all this kind of stuff, and I challenged him on that, and he said, well, that's my impression. Now, he hardly knew me, really, but he clearly had taken a dislike to me. And he said impressions are what's important, really. And he also said something about me not being sufficiently grateful to my parents for sending me to the school, etc. And he eventually reduced me to tears. And I left his office, in considerable confusion. And I would now see that clearly as emotional abuse by an authority figure.
And you were on the cusp, Gerald, of doing your leaving cert at that stage, is that correct?
That's right.
Your
sixth
year,
right. Actually, shortly before I did the leaving, he found me tying my shoe on with my foot on a bench that we weren't supposed to put our shoes on. And there was a notice on it, which I don't know, ran to about five lines, and he told me to write that out 500 times just before my leaving. I recruited some friends, and we got it done. But, you know, it was...
And did you ever see him inflict punishment on other pupils, other students? You're 16, 17, 18. You're not boys at this stage. You're a young man.
No, I don't think I would have seen that. Okay. You see, I mean, this wasn't casual physical abuse. The whole business of corporal punishment in Clonkis at the time was quite formal. There were only some priests who were allowed to administer it. And, of course, the prefect of studies was the ultimate authority, so he could, I suppose, beat anybody at any time when he felt like
it. So he's been described as menacing.
Yeah.
He's also been described as charismatic. He's been described as learned, music, German, French, seem to be well-read, big.
Can I come in there, Joe? Sorry,
yes,
Joe.
He was very clever,
Can I come in?
Yes.
Can I come in there?
Yeah.
He was a malevolent presence in the school.
Okay.
Now, there were fine teachers in there. Eileen McDonough, Paul Kelly, Peter Burke. No, hold on. Yeah. He was a malevolent presence. He had boys in his class singing Nazi marching songs.
Right.
And he that was an inside joke to him, because they wouldn't have known that was an Erika. It's infamous. It was written by a member of the Nazi party in the 30s.
Okay.
And he had them singing those songs. He used to get guys setting people on, like Mark Harold was telling you
yesterday.
And there was very... And the reason why I got onto you at all, Joe, was this idea that no one did anything. My dad did something. And yesterday the impression was created that Belvedere in the 70s was like the Dark Ages. It was a great place, only for him.
Okay.
It was a fabulous school.
Okay. Points well made there.
Yes, Joe.
Gerald, were you aware that the year after, I think it was the year after you left, there was a rebellion of sorts against Marmion?
Yeah, I mean, that's only hearsay on my part because I had left, but I was told that glue had been inserted in the lock to his office, which prevented him getting into his office, and graffiti had been sprayed on his office door.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my experience was probably not unique, but in those days, one didn't talk about that kind of thing, really, and I never spoke to anybody about it. You know, I kind of sucked it up, I suppose, and tried to put it aside and tried not to believe what he was saying. But nonetheless, to receive that kind of message from the headmaster of the school in your last year, as you're about to leave it, when you've
kind of progressed
pretty well in the school, it was very confusing, and it's certainly designed to undermine your self-confidence, and it succeeded to some extent in my case. But so I know that, you know, I don't think I ever met anybody who really liked the man, and some of them hated him, but I don't know about individual experiences, really.
Okay.
And that's part of the reason why
your point is
Jesuits said, they want to encourage people to
come forward,
And
as I say, the Jesuits say in their statement, it's a standalone sentence. All information regarding abuse is shared with An Garda Síochána Tuasal and other relevant authorities. Now, they say that reads as if that's a policy that had always been in situ in the Jesuits, but obviously it wasn't, because if somebody comes in and makes an allegation in 1977, and as we heard yesterday and today, there are allegations before that, but in 1977, if somebody comes in and says there's been a school trip, apparently this was a trip he organised every year, the confluence of German and music, and brought him to Vienna in Austria, and apparently he was the only adult on. We haven't heard otherwise. So for the only adult on the core,
he was the only adult.
Unbelievable stuff. But someone comes back
20 years later.
Someone comes back, Rocard, and says the allegation is to the authorities, this man drugged and raped somebody. That is the most heinous crime. I want to bring in Evan Daly. I'll come back to everyone, I promise, and then I'll take a break and I'll come back to everyone. Evan Daly is in Florida. Evan, good afternoon.
Good morning from me, Joe. How are you?
Of course, and thanks for joining us, Evan, and contacting us. Evan, you were in Belvedere, and this incredible picture you paint of Marmion inciting the class to beat up another a member of their class. What happened?
All right, so I was in Belvedere leaving in 1979, and this incident happened in 1976 when I was in third year, and my friend was in fourth. So I came out of my class one day, and mm-hmm. I'll call my friend Declan because he's now dead. And he was in the corridor, and he was disheveled, and his face was a mess.
Right.
His face was so badly beaten that he was nearly unrecognizable. I can remember how one side of his face was worse than the other. Mm. He looked like he'd been in a car crash. So I asked him what happened, and he said that Marmion had set the boys on him under threat that if they did not beat him, Marmion would beat them.
Good God.
Yeah. Now, I believe that that boy's parents filed a complaint. And I want to say something here about Father Barber. Father Barber was an excellent headmaster. He was in charge of hundreds of boys and many, many, many teachers. He was a fair man. He was very kind to me. And I believe that he did act on those complaints because Marmion was eventually pushed out. It wouldn't have been just Father Barber's decision to push him.
Yeah. And you're totally believing that your friend was correct when he said a teacher, Father Joseph Marmion, who held a senior position, he had encouraged the other boys to beat up your friend.
We were right in the corridor. Marmion was in the, you know, Marmion had just left some time before, and there was no doubt that Marmion was the instigator.
Okay,
that's
you
what
say.
Declan had said.
Okay, and as we heard from Mark Harold yesterday, he encouraged the class. I think the phrase was to get Harold, to get him, to beat him up. But you say there's
he
been
he tried that with us, Joe, but we wouldn't go for it. He hated us. We hated him. He tried that with us.
Okay,
and that's my opinion. And that's my opinion.
Okay.
One of the reasons why it was our year that the thing came to a head because we were rebellious. We didn't just obey. We questioned, and we didn't, and we tried the best that we could to not take any of his crap.
Evan, you say there's a conspiracy of silence around all of this. What do you mean?
It's been 45 years. We know that the first complaints came in 1977.
Well, we heard an allegation. We heard a story yesterday that the first complaint came in 1974.
Yeah. So what's happened in the last 45 years? The cost of addressing this by the Jesuits or whomever would have been financial and reputational.
Mm-hmm.
And now the chickens have come home to roost. It has to be dealt with.
And the Jesuits knew by the time he died, at least, he died in the year 2000. They knew because they say the disclosures were in 1977. And they acted on those disclosures inadequately, a lot of people would say, and unlawfully, a lot of people would say. They moved him around. But he's still buried, when he died in 2000, he still is buried in the Jesuit communal plot near the front gate of Glasnevin Cemetery, and he's marked down as such. So right until his death, they still regarded him as one of their own.
I can't make any excuses for how they did that.
Yeah, just an observation. Okay, if you stay with us, I'm going to talk to Joe Little, former religious affairs correspondent after the program here in RTE, about his interactions with Father Joseph Marmion, both as I say, boy and man. 51551, wash hands.
Talk to Joe on 1850-715-815.
And we're still getting calls about Father Joseph Marmion, who the Jesuit order, in a very unusual statement, that in many paragraphs left more questions than answers, But the opening line is, the Jesuit order in Ireland is making public the name of a former teacher and priest, Joseph Marmion, SJ, who abused boys sexually, emotionally and physically while he was on the teaching staff at Belvedere College in the 1970s. Now, we're also getting calls about when he was in the other Jesuit colleges in Clongowes and the Crescent in Limerick, which is where I think Joe Little, Joseph, good afternoon, Joe Little, former religious affairs correspondent, you recognise the voice, the minute you hear it. But Joe, when did you come across Joseph Marmion?
I came across him as a secondary school pupil in the Crescent in at the top of O'Connell Street in Limerick. It was then an all-male primary and secondary school, but he came into the school sometime in the early mid-60s, in the mid-60s, and I believe from the statement the Jesuits issued that he had left. He left for Belvedere in 69. And he didn't teach me during his time there, but he did teach my late older brother, Pather, who was a year older than me.
Okay.
And he taught him German. And I do remember Pather telling us at mealtime at home about his rather eccentric behavior in class. For instance, he... if memory serves correctly, and I can't check this obviously with Pather, but some of his classmates may remember if they're listening, he on at least one occasion told a student who had committed some misdemeanor or got something wrong, I don't know what had happened, got something wrong in his lesson, but he told him to stand up at the blackboard, drew a circle on the blackboard and told him to put his nose into that circle and to keep it there. But, of course, the circle was drawn in such a way as the boy was on his tippy toes in order to reach it. And, you know, each time he shifted out of the circle, he would be undermined with a caustic remark and told to put his nose back up there. And my father... coincidentally, had been at secondary school with Joe Marmion.
Okay.
And told us that this fitted, you know, his memory of Marmion and that he was a bully. He remembered Joe Marmion taking a cup which the school had won in a rugby tournament. Now, maybe it was just an internal league at the school or something. And throwing it in a rubbish bin. Now, he must have had... a lot of physical capabilities to do that as a secondary school pupil, given that he was angering a group of rugby players, you know, in his year or in the year below him or whatever, the years below him. But he was very antagonistic towards the boys who played rugby at the school and retained that dislike of sport and used to rant about sport, you know, people stupidly chasing a pig's bladder around him. And he had a great facility with language and was, you know, capable of putting himself out there as the be-all and end-all and in quite a menacing way. But on the other hand, I was certainly ambivalent towards him because he was also... hugely talented. Where I did come across him as a student being instructed by him was in the musicals which he staged in the Crescent in the Sicilian Hall, which was directly next door to the school. And he put a huge amount of work into those musicals. And I recall him playing the piano at rehearsals in the basement of the school and the beads of sweat standing out on his forehead, and he was clearly very invested in the musical productions. They were generally Austrian or German, and he, as you probably heard, he translated the libretto into English, and he would have had Burke's costumers, you know, in Dame Street in Dublin, deliver down a set of costumes. The thing that worries me about him is that, like MacLean in the abusive teacher in Terenure, that he may have been involved in the fitting of costumes.
And, oh, he was. We heard in stories yesterday about that.
And I hope that nobody I sang with in those productions, or that nobody who was in any of those productions was sexually abused by him. I heard no mention of allegations of sexual abuse.
Let's hear. A lot of people have spoken about his voice. This is an interview you did with him, with Joseph Marmion in 2000. This is Joe Little, but the voice you'll hear is of Joseph Marmion.
He was in the coffin, I think, about 40 years. And his body was incorrupt after 40 years, which was amazing. His vestments had deteriorated a great deal, and the actual body itself was extraordinarily preserved.
I don't know, how would you describe that accent, Joe?
Well, he was born in Liverpool.
Okay.
And had I knew this through my father.
Okay.
I understand that his parents were Irish, but, you know, like so many Irish people of their vintage would have emigrated and started their family abroad. His father, I believe, was a doctor. But when asked about his Liverpudlian background, apparently he once told somebody in a conversation that just because a cat has her kittens in an oven doesn't mean that they're buns. You know, he had that kind of facility with language.
And then when did you come across him again? What was the occasion of that interview, Joe?
It was 31 years after I'd seen him at the school in the Crescent. I was assigned to do a preparatory report on the beatification of his granduncle, Dom Columba Marmion.
Okay.
And I rang the Jesuit Communications Office, and, you know, I knew of the relationship. So I asked, would Joe Marmion still be alive? Would he be willing to give an interview if he was? And I was told he wasn't well, but that he would give an interview. So I went up to Gardiner Street, up to the community beside Francis Xavier Church there, and met him and did the interview. And he seemed very well to me for a man of 75. He was still burly and, as you can hear, very silver-tongued and well able to deliver a description of his granduncle's body at the time of the preparations for the beatification and so on, the investigations that are done.
And Joe, of all your religious affairs correspondent here for many, and as well as working on investigative programmes as well and doing your own investigation when you were religious affairs correspondent, what was your reaction when you heard about the statement the other day, this bald statement from the Jesuits beginning, "The Jesuit Order in Ireland is making public the name of a former teacher and priest, Joseph Marmion, SJ, who abused boys sexually, emotionally and physically while he was on the teaching staff at Belvedere College in the 1970s. That type of statement is almost unprecedented from a religious order, naming somebody who's deceased.
It is, but the Pope, the current Pope, has made it obligatory for anybody in the Catholic Church who knows about the abuse of minors or vulnerable adults to report this.
Mm-hmm.
And it's certainly in the spirit of that approach to abuse.
But on the other hand, Joe,
that he be named. But the problem is, why was he allowed by the Irish province of the Jesuits to remain on the staff in Belvedere? It seems to me this is a problem that must be addressed by the Jesuits.
And what is it? Remember,
albeit till the end of an academic year, it seems to me that smacks of the institution being protected.
Yeah.
Because to dismiss him or to suspend him from the staff after those complaints were made of horrendous behaviour, absolutely horrendous. Even for sexual abuse, this was horrendous.
But who and when?
Was a way of making sure there wasn't any gossip. But why did Marmion disappear off the scene?
All of a sudden after the Vienna trip. But who and when decided he was guilty?
Well, I don't know. My experiences of this are that if complaints are examined and seen to be credible, then they are... people can be sidelined, put on administrative leave if the complaint is credible. Obviously, in the case of a deceased abuser, if the complaints are credible, there is a greater interest in making this known and having mm-hmm. people come forward
but what
for,
they
for
don't,
assistance.
But, Joe, what they don't say in the statement, and it's a long statement, they do say he's guilty. He is a paedophile. He abused boys sexually. They're not saying there are allegations. They say categorically, we are making the name public of a former teacher and priest who abused boys sexually, emotionally, physically. Now, that raises the question, one, what was the evidence? And two, maybe Marmion confessed when he was confronted. But that's not mentioned in the statement. And if he confessed when he was confronted, why wasn't it brought to the Gardaí?
They're
the questions you'll be asking long before I ever got to them, I suspect. But
yeah,
I take your point.
The reality is that victims, some people are survivors of abuse and others are victims. The important thing is to get to the survivors before they become victims. The important thing is to put it out there as soon as possible so that survivors can be helped to continue to survive. Some people just haven't been able to sustain the pain of enduring this kind of abuse. And it's extraordinary, it seems extraordinary to me that this is only being put out now when we have had scandals since the Father Brendan Smith scandal, I suppose, was the first major one, and that was in 1994. And it has taken until now for anything to be... We don't think anything was reported to the authorities while Marmion was still alive up to 2000. And one would have thought that when there was a delay in dismissing him from the staff or suspending him from the staff in Belvedere, that the scale should be redressed in some way or another by telling the world that this man had abused and inviting people to come forward for help a lot earlier than now.
Mm-hmm. But they say the Jesuits have been in contact over many years with others who were abused by Joseph Marmion while they were young students. They've spoken of sexual abuse and physical. So they've known about this and have been in contact with victims for many years. Now, does that include he died? He's the inscription on the headstone in Glasnevin Cemetery says Father Joseph Marmion, OB 15, I presume that's Old Belvedere, November 2000. Which is 21 years ago. He was 74 years of age. But what did he tell them going back to 1977 when they say they were first confronted? Catherine is there, Joe at RT.ie before the break. Catherine, good afternoon. From another angle, you knew him in 1996 until he died in the year 2000. How did you come across him, Catherine?
Hello, Joe. Yes. I went up to St. Vincent's Private Hospital to see a friend of mine who was in and out. She was in and out for about 3 years of the private there, and she did die then eventually in 2000. But she said to me, there's a nice oratory downstairs. This is around 1997, I think. And I went down, and there was Mass on, and there was this priest saying the Mass, and he was given a sermon, and... I never heard anything like it. I thought it was fascinating the way he was brought the scripture to life. That's how I would describe it. And I was just to find out then that this man was the chaplain at the hospital. And I got used to going there. And, I used to go up because he always said a quick Mass. And he
that was mentioned yesterday as well.
Yeah, the 15-minute Mass. And you know, I used to see him around the hospital and that, and just down in the canteen. But
and Catherine, when I play his voice, I'll play it for you again. When I play his voice, now I know it's later in life, but when we play Joseph Marmion's voice, that clip that from the interview, just see what does this remind you of his voice, which you say was very charismatic.
He was in the coffin, I think, about 40 years, and his body was incorrupt after 40 years. Which was amazing. His vestments had deteriorated a great deal, and the actual body itself was extraordinarily preserved.
As someone said, very well spoken, very crisp, clear enunciation.
Yeah.
Did you ever have conversations with him, Catherine?
Very little. Very very, very little. That was the thing I used to find strange, because I used to go regularly then, because I have to be honest with you, Joe, I used to go up to hear him talk because he was so interesting. He used to tell us stories about St. Paul and all his travels in Philippi and in Malta, and he'd say, now he says, St. Paul used to swim on such and such a beach. Now, I've been there. And he brought the sort of scripture to life.
Right, okay.
And it's not that I'm overly religious or anything, but he was a very ebullient, he was very pleasant. He used to come into the oratory in his vestments, all sort of, he was always full of life and full of enthusiasm.
And Catherine, when you heard he had passed away, what was your reaction?
I was sad. Because I saw him actually a couple of times when he'd come in and out. I used to continue to go there.
Okay.
I subsequently did get involved in the private hospital doing voluntary work.
And then when you heard the statement from the Jesuit saying he was a paedophile, he abused boys sexually, emotionally and physically.
I felt sick, Joe. I felt sick. And my brother actually, I had a brother who was abused by a priest. And he died in the early 1980s. And any time I hear things like that, I listen very, very carefully. And my brother did not survive that abuse.
Oh,
and I could talk an awful lot about that. Yeah. He suffered all his life until he died tragically in his 30s. And it was all because of the secrecy that he had to hold. He did try to talk about it, but nobody would listen to him.
Okay.
Sad, isn't it? Yeah.
Okay, Catherine, thanks indeed. That's Catherine in Dublin. We'll be talking, or hearing from more people who knew Joseph Marmion after this break. joe@rte.ie.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815. Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
We're still getting calls about Father Joseph Marmion, who's buried in Glasnevin. He was a member of the Jesuits order for many, many years. And the Jesuits this week, on this past Tuesday, March the 2nd, 2021, revealed in a statement that he was abusing boys sexually, emotionally and physically while he was on their teaching staff while he was a Jesuit. Tom O'Sullivan. Tom, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe.
You say 52 years ago, and I never talked about it, but hearing people, and I know you heard Joe Little there.
I know Joe Little. He was a year or so behind me. I know his brother Pater as well.
Okay, Pater's deceased, unfortunately. But you were a pupil in the Crescent College.
I was, yeah, from 1965 to 71.
Do you remember Marmion?
Oh, I remember Marmion, yes. Okay. There were two sides to him, Joe, and people have alluded to it. He could be very entertaining, charming, witty, but there was a nasty, vindictive side to the man, and I experienced that. Joe Little mentioned his unusual tastes in punishment. And German poetry, he would turn to me in class and he would say, Tom, the poem we are studying, would you recite it for us, please?
Okay.
And you would. And then he would look at you and say, now, Tom, who would I ask next?
Right.
So you were put in the position of choosing one of your classmates, and you were praying that whoever you picked knew the poem.
Okay.
But two of my classmates, thank God, they worked out a system. And we'd meet 5 minutes before class.
Okay.
And every one of us had one or two names. You see, if you kept asking the same person, he'd figure out what was going on.
Okay.
But they came up with a kind of random system. Another punishment of his was the duck walk.
Okay.
He'd make you, in front of all your classmates at the top of the class, he'd make you walk across the classroom on your hunkers, which are behind touching your heels, in other words. Now, if you do that 20 times over and back, you can't stand up. Your legs are so painful and weak. My worst experience with him was I was in his German class, and he had me up at the board Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. to write out the German definite article. It's unusual in that it's masculine, feminine, neuter and plural.
Okay.
But while I was trying to write it on the board, he would walk around the class and he would bang the leather that he always carried against the rostrum, the back of the door, on other pupils' desks, and he would say out loud what punishment I was going to receive if I didn't succeed in writing out the German definite article correctly. And of course I failed. I was, what, 15, 16? But Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, I got slapped, and slapped hard. Mm. Now, he had a long rectangular leather, about a half inch thick. And instead of slapping you across the palm of your hand, he would slap you along the length of your hand. In other words, the soft pad just under your thumb would receive the real heavy blows.
From the pandy bat, someone called it yesterday.
And no, what he had then, for me, it wasn't the pandy bat. It was long and rectangular and quite heavy.
Okay.
And
what about this thing of putting your hand in your mouth?
I'll tell you in a minute.
Okay.
So on the Thursday, he threw me out of the class. Or on the Friday, he threw me out of the class. And I was outside our prefect of studies office, and I was in tears. And I cried, Joe, not because of the slaps, I could put up with that, but because I couldn't fight back. I had nothing to fight back with. And our counsellor at the time, Father Niall O'Neill, came along and he saw me and he said, what's wrong? And I said it to him. I said, Father, I said, it's Marmion. It's Marmion. So he brought me into his room, and it was the first time in my life that a Jesuit gave me cigarettes. So I smoked a cigarette with Niall O'Neill, and I told him what happened and what had been going on in class. Then he said to me that the Prefect of Studies would see me. So I went out and I had a word with the Prefect of Studies. And he told me to go home and write the German article out 6, 7, 8 times, 10 times, until it became automatic. But you're writing out at home when you're safe, and having to do it on the blackboard in front of your class with this... He was a very big man, walking around behind you, hitting the desk and hitting the rostrum and telling you out loud what was going to happen. Of course you failed. Now, Joe Little mentioned the operettas. I have no knowledge of sexual abuse. But I did see him hurt and be terribly cruel to people, including myself. Another pupil, he would just crumple up his German copy and throw it in the waste paper basket. And the boy had to get up from his desk, walk across the class, pick his copy out of the waste paper basket, and he would have to try and smooth it out. So that he could take part in the German class. But you asked me about the fingers in the mouth. The operettas. And again, this is a side of Joe Marmion that many people have referred to. He was a superb musician. He really was wonderful to watch when he played the piano and listen to. But if we were rehearsing A Night in Venice was the opera, Joe Little might remember. But if you were rehearsing, and if he thought you weren't singing with enough gusto, he would... I hope I can describe this. If you put all the fingers of your hand together, with the thumb pointing down, he would make you put the full width of your hand into your mouth. You'd have to open your mouth. He'd make you do that 20, 25, 30 times. And again, you have to do this in front of the other pupils who were there rehearsing with you. But I mean, I saw more than one boy reduced to tears because of the pain. You know?
Your hand in your mouth, four fingers, and push it in and out 30 times.
Open your mouth fully and fit the full width of your hand into your mouth and take it out, close your mouth, put it in, take it out, put it in, take it out. Do that 25 times.
And what's it been like for you, Tom, hearing these stories over the last few days since the Jesuits issued their statement on Tuesday, even though it's a long time ago?
He left in 1969 to go to Belvedere. And it's only when I heard your programme yesterday that I remembered the sense of relief we felt when he had left the Crescent. We actually felt sorry for the lads in Belvedere. I spoke to your researcher, Lisa, and I also spoke to the Jesuit Safeguard Office. I spoke to Lorraine there. Now, can I say about the Jesuit Safeguard Office?
Yeah.
They were absolutely wonderful.
Right.
They were patient. Mm-hmm. They were kind. They encouraged me to get in touch whenever I felt that I needed to. But like Joe Little, the claim that they knew about Father Marmion in 1977, I'm sorry, Joe, but I find it so hard to believe that.
Yeah.
Because I was in the Crescent, and Marmion was my German teacher from 1967, 68, 68, 69.
Okay.
And I'm bewildered to try and think that other teachers didn't know what he was doing.
Okay, now, we've been contacted by many people, including Tom and the others you've heard, but we were contacted overnight by a man who was sexually abused by Joseph Marmion. He reported this to the Jesuit Order in 2019, and it was his report that led to the name of Marmion. He asked for it to be done as a paedophile this week. Here is what he wrote to us.
In 1972, when I was 13 years of age and a student of Belvedere College, I was thrilled to be chosen in the chorus for the school opera, The Beggar Student, to be performed in January 1973. One late afternoon, as me and my fellow village chorus began to stream away from the regular after-school singing practice, Marmion asked me to stay behind to be measured for a costume. He spent a few minutes tidying up his music books on top of the piano and then told me to follow him. We left the music room, which was opposite the school chapel, left the main building, crossed the schoolyard and climbed up the stairs to a room that had a series of rails with Bavarian-style costumes hanging from them. He told me to get fully undressed, and when I was completely naked, he kneeled down in front of me and proceeded to roll a pair of nylon tights up my legs to my waist. He then sexually molested me. I cannot remember for how long. I was terrified. He stopped only when the door opened suddenly and another man's head appeared around it. A very short conversation happened and the door closed again. Marmion fitted me with a costume and then I was allowed to leave and I went home. One day in 1978, after I had left Belvedere, and probably as he was in the process of being removed, I saw him striding in his unmistakable bouncy manner down Marlborough Street, a shock of grey hair and his black winged soutane flying behind him. The feeling of terror that came over me was so panic-inducing that I ran up the steps of the Pro-Cathedral and hid, crouched behind a pillar until he had passed by. I was 18 years of age and he had terrified me since I was 13. This week I'm enormously sad, but I know the sadness will ease as the noise dies down. Right now I'm sad for the boys who were harmed, for their childhoods that were marred, for their self-confidence, self-worth and ability to trust that was damaged, for their families who may have had to deal with unusual moods or behaviours, and for the opportunities they have lost. And I feel sad for those Jesuits who have no guilt in this, but I hope that, with time, all involved will find some healing and some way of repairing the damage. My therapy was my determination to publicly expose Marmion and give a voice to others who may have been harmed. I hope others can find their therapy.
And that communication from that man who led to the naming publicly this week of Joseph Marmion was voiced by our producer Fergus Sweeney. Back after this break.
Talk to Joe on 1850-715-815. Talk to Joe on 1850-715-815.
I'm still getting calls about Father Joseph Marmion. Evan Daly, can I go back to you just briefly? Having listened to that letter from the survivor of Marmion, who insisted that the Jesuits name him publicly so people can, like Tom, and who have issues they want aired, can air them in a helpful way. Evan, what do you think of that letter and the fact that Marmion got away with it for so long?
Well, it was very brave of that man, now man, to come out and discuss what had happened to him so long ago. And I'm a bit cynical about all of this admissions and these letters from the Jesuits. I live in America. I feel a lawsuit coming. Something's coming down. The other foot is about to drop on this. And I feel that by coming out and writing that statement, the victim has given a voice to any other victim that wants to come forward. And I believe there are many others, because I heard stories about boys in the opera having issues with Marmion, which I'm not going to go into because I don't have any direct experience of it. But there's more coming, in my opinion.
And I know you were involved in the podcast as well, Where is George Gibney? It's very reminiscent of, I know Gibney is still alive, that's the difference, but it's very reminiscent of Gibney. Now, Gibney never faced justice in terms of a court, and Marmion never faced justice. But I'm still baffled as what do the Jesuit order know that they are so adamant that he was a paedophile? And obviously no one doubts it from all our calls at this stage, but usually a religious order will say we received allegations and we'll investigate the allegations. Did Marmion actually confess, and when did he do so? I want to go to Dara O'Malley, who's contacted us. Dara, good afternoon.
Hi, Joe. Hi, okay. Good to speak with you.
This is Dara, the actor. Yeah. An actor, among other things, yes. Dara, yeah. you were, just people will recognise your voice, I think. You were a pupil of Marmion in the Crescent in Limerick.
Yeah, that's right. Primary school, I went to St. Philomena's, and then you graduated to the Crescent. My father had been at the Crescent, and I think I arrived there in 1964, and then proceeded to secondary school, and then encountered Marmion, who was, Joe, an absolute monster. I mean, my engagement with him was, I was 6'2" when I was 12, 13 years of age, so I wasn't a pretty boy, but I had him for German, and he gave me terrible emotional abuse for several years. I mean, he wouldn't hand me the copy books. He'd throw it at me, and if something wasn't to his satisfaction, he would crumple it up, as a previous caller, I think, said, and throw it in the rubbish bin. So this was pretty relentless. I had a great interest in theater, and I auditioned. He never put me in the school operettas, so I built a little theater in the garage of my house. And also, my father was a sitting TD in Limerick at the time, and the abuse, the emotional abuse, went up a notch, or several notches, when Donough O'Malley announced free education in 1967, because the one thing that he had to do was he had to get the religious orders on side, and the professions as well, the legal profession and the medical profession were not too happy about this. I don't think they would have fancied having Joe Duffy down in the law library in those years with his dulcet tones, but that's on for another program. But Joe Marmion, yeah, it was relentless. But the whole setup in Crescent College then, I mean, the priest's bedrooms, Joe, were within 20 feet of the classrooms. And many boys were taken to the priest's bedrooms, I do remember clearly, to engage in spiritual knowledge. And, you know, it was relentless. And everybody knew. And actually, you know, it's not just Marmion's time in Crescent. I remember having a conversation about his years in the Crescent with Richard Harris. Mm-hmm. And Dickie Harris would, you know, make faces whenever his time at the Crescent was mentioned. But that,
you mentioned the fact, and of course people would know your father was minister for pioneering, changed my life anyway in one fell swoop, I can tell you, for positively when he introduced free second level education, listeners, introduced by Dara's father, Fianna Fáil, Minister for Education, and he died prematurely, and indeed his anniversary is next week, so I'm very conscious of that as well, Dara. But did you mention it to your dad? Did anyone say, or was it just taken as this guy?
My dad didn't know Marmy, and he wasn't there then, he didn't carry really home the stories. But it was a time of great kind of unhappiness. And when Donagh announced the free education, of course, they turned on him. They turned on, you know, and they vented it through Marmy, and they vented it through me. And of course, that was 1967. Mm-hmm. And in 1968, Donagh died. So then they, you know, it was a free for all. And I decided I had to leave the Crescent. And the natural place to go was then to Clongowes, where my father had gone as a boarder. But they didn't. They didn't play soccer. Like what annoyed the Jesuits in my time as well was I played soccer.
Okay.
But what would at the time have been termed working class soccer, and I also played rugby. But as I said, I was 6'2" when I was 12 or 13, so that was a walkover. But I'd play for Crescent College on a Sunday morning, and then I'd go and play with Wembley Rovers on a Sunday afternoon. And this really annoyed the Jesuits. But when the free education was, you know, it opened up a kind of, you know,
and a number of schools didn't go along with, including fee. That's
absolutely
why they became fee paying schools.
Absolutely, but we're, you know, just to focus, keep this focus on Joe Marmy. And I think, you know, a lot of people, you know, with the operettas and everything, you know, there was an omerta within the priesthood, certainly the priests, but everybody kind of, you know, knew something was going on. I mean, we didn't even have the word camp at that time, but there were, you know, one or two camp lay teachers in the Crescent then at the time as well. And they seemed to kind of have a little kind of clique that was going on. And as I said, the bedrooms were so close to the classrooms. It was quite, it was extraordinary. But
Stay with us, Dara.
So just to finish my tale. So I went to Turnure College then, and of course ran into John McLean.
Oh, my God. Who's now in prison? Who's now in prison for abusing children?
Yeah. So, you know, you carry a certain amount of emotional scars, but it's, you know, it hasn't. It's not an area that has been dealt with in Ireland at all, Joe. Okay. And
I'm very conscious, Dara, that a number of people are saying even to talk about it now is helping. Even I'm talking about outside of this program.
Absolutely,
people are in WhatsApp groups or whatever talking about it. Joe Little wanted to come back in there, listening to Dara. Joe,
hello, Joe. Hello, Dara. You recruited into a soccer team many years ago too. Nice to hear your voice. Just wanted to say that the story of Joe Marmion has assumed huge proportions. Of course, as a journalist, Joe, you would know, and Dara would know as an observer of things in the public sphere, because of the social class, you know, in which he moved, and where he was regarded as a paragon of virtue for a long time. But there are many people listening today whose relatives will have suffered abuse in mm-hmm. institutions where they had far fewer spear carriers to come out and speak up for them.
Well,
and I just want to make that point because, you know, the Marmion story has this certain cachet attached to it. But I remember my father sitting down and saying to me shortly after we arrived in Limerick that he was doing all he could do to make sure that we wouldn't be sent to school in the Christian Brothers because a cousin of mine had been thrashed by a Christian Brother in a town not too far away. And my father was determined that we weren't going to be exposed to that. And in relation to Marmion and corporal punishment, the rule in Jesuit schools was that no one was permitted to, as someone has said earlier in the program, no one was permitted to inflict corporal punishment without being a part of a system which was based on a docket. A docket was written out for you to have four or six slaps.
Yeah.
And you brought that down to the headmaster's office and you were given your medicine. Marmion carrying a strap, if that's true that he carried a strap around in the classroom, was a breach of the rules. But the most important thing that has emerged in what I've heard on this program so far is that a head peeped around the door
mm-hmm.
while this boy was being abused. And I went to the funeral of a former Jesuit teacher of mine, Philip Hartnett, many years ago in Francis Xavier Church in Gardiner Street,
mm-hmm.
and was approached by a man, a Jesuit, who knew my family, and I didn't know him at all, but he was talking to me about my coverage and general coverage of clerical child sexual abuse, and he said, of course, you know, we just know nothing about this, you know?
Yeah.
And another Jesuit who had joined the conversation turned to him and said, what do you mean we know nothing about this?
Yeah. Well, they did, and they've admitted it publicly. Now, I want to bring in Shane Slattery. Shane, good afternoon. You were in Belvedere until 1974.
Yeah. Hi, Joe. How are you?
And do you remember Marmion?
I do. I remember him well, Joe. And just my story that I was saying to your researchers, I was... there was a debate with a girls' school
mm-hmm.
one night in the school, and he was moderator. And... after the debate, we all went down to the common room, and I was the last arriving in, and I let a big roar out of me and fall to the table.
Right.
And I hadn't seen him there. He was in the room. And so he came over to me, and he totally humiliated me in front of all the pupils there, the girls and the boys, and, you know, proceeded to say you're a complete failure and no use in this and no use in that, and you're no good at rugby, you're no good at lessons, you're no good at this. So went on for about 5 minutes, Joe, and I was stunned into silence, and the room was completely silent. So I was there and he left, and then I said to a friend of mine at the time, Joe Curtin, I said, I'm not taking that from him. And I said, I'm going to find him. And so we went up. He came up with me and we went. We could see him. He was in a room. The lights were on in a room that he used to play the piano.
Right.
And we could look in from the outside. And I said to Joe, look, you stay there and I go in and confront him. So I went in and he was sitting down playing the piano. When he saw me coming in and he looked up and smiled, and I said to myself, he thinks I'm coming in to apologise.
Okay.
So I walked up to him, and I won't use the language I used to him, but I effed and blinded him out of it, and I said, don't you ever effing talk to me like that again.
Okay.
Or I'll take your bloody head off. And now, he was a big man.
I know, that's what I'm very conscious of that. You, a student, standing, he was an enormous man by some descriptions anyway. But anyway, how did he react when you gave him the full...
He jumped up out of the chair, Joe, and I said, here we go. I said to myself, here we go. He's going to go for me.
Yeah.
But he he didn't. He just stared at me for about 10 seconds, and then he left the room, and he stormed out of the room. And I went back, and I went back to Joe, and we went back down to the lads, and I told him what happened. But anyway, the next morning, Joe, I was in class, and Father Barber came in, and he just said, "Shane Slattery, get your bags and go home." And I presumed then I was expelled. And so I said, right, fair enough. So I went home and I explained it to my mother in Poland. So she was back and forth with Barber for a few days and talking about it. And I think after about five, and meanwhile, there was the fellow Jim O'Leary, who was in class with me, he's an economist now.
Mm-hmm.
He had organised a petition that among our year that everyone signed to get me back in.
Right. Okay.
And so after about 5 days, anyway, she said, look, go in and see, you can go back, but you go in and see Barber first, Father Barber first. So I went in to see him the morning I went back, and I explained to him exactly what had happened, because obviously he had got a warped view from Marmion of what went on. And he said to me, right, he said, look, I'm going to take you back, but I'd like you to apologise to Father Marmion. And I said, well, Father Barber, if that's conditional on me coming back, I won't be coming back, because I'm not apologising to that man. And he said, no, it's not conditional. And so he said, look, you can go back to class.
Well,
and
done.
Later on that morning, I was walking up a corridor, and Marmion was walking towards me. And he looked stunned, and I just smiled at him, and I thought he was going to absolutely go for me. He didn't know how to handle it, because he had been confronted. But he was an out-and-out bully, Joe.
Okay.
A complete and utter psychopath. And I have since heard stories from people I know that he did sexually abuse.
And we've more coming in. My thanks to all our callers today. Each and every one, and really appreciate it. And I'll be back after this break.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
Joe Duffy!
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
Before I go, the passing this week of Owen Nolan cannot go unremarked on national radio, and especially in a programme like Liveline, driven by its listeners and driven by radio advertising, because Owen Nolan was a creative genius, and he was a great believer in radio ads, good, informative, funny radio ads. And Owen, his funeral took place on Tuesday. Everyone, when I ask you to look up Owen's podcast on Lyric FM, they're absolutely fantastic. They're called Unreasonable Point of View. They're on Lyric. Do you know the Glasnevin posters? They're brilliant. 28 Biggs, three fellows, one Michael Collins, and then that play on all the names in Glasnevin. North, south, east, west, they're all names. 43 heirs, 522 graces, they're all names. They were the work of Owen Nolan, who was a creative genius. And if you just want a glimpse of how regarded he was, just go on to rip.ie and read. You would spend a long time reading the messages from people from all walks of Irish life that knew Owen and are so saddened by his untimely passing. To Niamh O'Flynn, his wife, to Carver Art and MacDara, our deepest sympathy. Today's programme was produced by the series producer Rebecca Meehan.
1850 715 815 stays open until 3:15 p.m. or email joe@rte.ie.